This podcast delves into the dark, the depraved, and all things to keep you up at night. Listener discretion is advised. Now, sit back, pull the covers over your head, and allow yourself to be taken on a journey through the abyss.
In the alleyways of London, the Ripper hides from sight, patiently awaiting the ladies of the night. Marian Nichols, a Whitechapel whore, is standing in the lamplight, hoping she can score. The streets are all empty, so she starts to walk on home, passing the evil Ripper, who sees that she's alone. Emerging from the shadows, he pulls her to the ground. Her mouth is muffled in his hand. She cannot make a sound. He draws a savage dagger from underneath his coat, and showing her no mercy, he swiftly cuts her throat. He shifts her to the shadows and removes her underwear. He rips her private places and leaves the body there. Then, like an apparition, he disappears, unseen. The most notorious killer that there has ever been.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Through the Abyss podcast. I'm your co-host, Ben.
And I'm your co-host, Mandy.
How are you doing today, Mandy?
I'm not going to lie. I am still feeling like crap. I don't know why. I think it's because I worked like 8,000 hours this week.
8,000 hours would do it.
Yeah.
I feel like I got hit by a bus, but who knows? Maybe
yeah,
I'm
so
fine.
We're going to apologize if we sound really monotone. It's not that we're bored with this topic. We're just dead, basically. We're like
Definitely not bored with the topic.
Yeah, this is Ben's baby. This is his six-week baby that he's going to be talking to us about, which I'm super looking forward to because I don't know as much about this subject as he does, but it's always one that's fascinated me.
Yeah, and it's been a while since I've researched this stuff, but it's exciting stuff to me. So it'll be good to get, you know, reacquainted and get back into it. I've got tons of books, etc. But yeah, we'll be looking for 6 weeks on the crimes of Jack the Ripper.
And I like the way that we've got this. You've got this set up is that, excuse me. We're the first 5 weeks are focusing on the victims because I think a lot of true crime tends to kind of gloss over the victims a little bit because, you know, I mean, let's face it. The actual crime itself is more, forgive me for saying this, interesting, but I really enjoy the fact that we're kind of hitting hard, given a specific episode to each one of his victims before we actually get into this guy himself. I think that's kind of important. I think that's something a lot of the time people seem to overlook a lot.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's important, one, to give the victims the respect that they deserve, right? But two, I think, you know, if you were an investigator, like you wouldn't lump everything together. That's how you lose details. And I think a lot of times with the Jack the Ripper cases, you know, you'll see like five paragraphs and it's gone through every single crime all together, right? Where there's little nuances to each one, where if there had only been one crime, it would have been a lot more thoroughly presented every time, right? But they've kind of mashed them all together and like, this guy cuts people up and this is what he did. And these are the people and these are the suspects. And, you know, you see these Jack the Ripper stories that are like a page long and you really can't cram this all into a page.
No, you can't. I mean, and honestly, I mean, he's not the most prolific serial killer by any means.
No.
I mean, I think everybody's super fascinated by it because number one, nobody truly knows who he is or who he was, I should say. And I mean, I think this was really the first recorded serial killings in history, right? Because I know H.H. Holmes was right along the same time too.
I think that we'd be close. I mean, I don't think that's an unfair guess, right? Like it's possible. But I would say too, like as far as him being not being as prolific as some of the other serial killers, you know, he also lived in a different time, right? Like Ted Bundy drove all over multiple states with his little Volkswagen Bug, right?
Right.
Jack the Ripper didn't have a car, right? So kind of like what he was able to do on foot in a city that had so much crime that it had a beat police officer on every single street corner, you know, in very tight knit little areas, was kind of amazing.
It actually is, considering, you know, I mean, like you said, this, I mean, we'll go over kind of what this area was like back then and what it is now, but I mean, it was close knit. I mean, but there, I don't know. At the same time, you got to keep in mind that how really afraid do you think this guy was of the cops? Because all they had were their flashlights and whistles. You know, they didn't carry guns or anything like that. So, you know, Jack's armed with knives and scalpels and whatever else he is. But I mean, I think he's
That's true. I mean, but the thing about their whistles is they were close enough that if they whistled, like five more show up, like stat, right? But
that's true.
And several of the crimes you'll see too that with the timelines they give, he committed the murders within 5 minutes of the police or a witness showing up, right? So it's kind of, he didn't seem too afraid. He was kind of there till the very end.
Yeah, yeah. And we'll definitely get into the psychology behind this guy in later episodes. But just to dive into kind of what Whitechapel is now, it's, of course, the East End of London. And, you know, while there are still some bad parts or whatnot, it's a very diverse and very bustling district. You know, it's kind of where the alternative music is found, and they've got art scenes, and it's just a popular, safe, well-connected place to live. Completely opposite now of what it was back in the 1880s.
Yeah, in the 1880s, right, you've got gas lights at the end of every street, right? So it's a lot of dark alleys. The residents are kind of living in fear because the area is so crime-ridden. It actually was a perfect place for a serial killer to emerge because there were so many murders in the area anyways. The red light district was a big part of that area, right? So prostitution was running rampant. Jobs were very, very scarce, especially for women. They turned to prostitution a lot. Some of them would be servants at homes and things like that. But for the most part, they had a lot of trouble working if their husbands didn't have jobs that were good enough, because of the desolation of the area and the amount of crime, and just no one wanted to be there, right? Unless you were up to no good.
True. And I honestly, when I think about Whitechapel in the 1880s, I kind of get this romantic picture of it. You know, you see these long stretches of alleyways with these gaslit lamps. And in my head, I have pictures of, you know, fog kind of bouncing off the streets and off of the walls. And it's just, it's creepy at the same time. It would be a picture I would hang in my house.
Yeah, no, I agree. Even like pictures of, you know, paintings that have been done of the Jack the Ripper and his crime areas and stuff are kind of, there's a romanticism. It kind of involves, weird to say, but there is.
It really is. And it also kind of reminds me of, like, do you know anything about the Five Points in New York, like during the Civil War times? Because that's what Whitechapel back then kind of reminds me of. It's very gritty and dirty, and you've got gangs running rampant, and it's just not a safe area. That's kind of how, you know, when you take the romanticism out of it, that's kind of how I view it, you know, when you get into the really real life picture of 1880s Whitechapel. It reminds me of a lot of what I think the Five Points in New York would have looked like.
Yeah, that sounds like a reasonable synopsis of it. Like I said, it was a perfect time and place for someone to do this kind of thing, because even when the crimes occur and they're looking for victims, there were so many bad people. It was like, could have been this guy for sure, or maybe this guy, or these three other guys. You know, it's like,
yeah, because like, I mean, on top of criminals, you've got, it's like alcoholism is a must, if we want to put it blatantly. It's a must to be in Whitechapel. If you're there, you're probably an alcoholic. So, I mean, people are in their right minds when they're drunk off of their gourd. So it's, yeah, I mean, how do you pick one criminal from another? You just can't. It's impossible.
Right. And it's interesting you brought up the alcohol, because that's like one of our first victim. one of her major issues was alcoholism, and it certainly didn't help her to stay alive. Right. So,
right.
It was a problem for everyone in that area. Just when you have nothing to look forward to in life, you kind of turn to substances, right. To kind of hide from reality. So it was very, very sad place to be.
Yes, definitely.
All right, guys. Just right before we go in and jump into Marianne Nichols and the story of what happened to her, I do want to say I had kind of mentioned about the beat of the police in Whitechapel. That was the first time that had occurred. That was kind of like a police, what's the word? It was a new thing, right? So London police came up with that, right? Fingerprinting was brand new. So even though clearly Jack the Ripper probably left a lot of evidence all over the place, right? Clearly there's no forensics that could really be done back there then. And fingerprinting was kind of like a science that was kind of laughed at that point in time, right? Now fingerprints is 100%. You leave a fingerprint, you're done, right? But yeah, back then, not a thing, right? So it had just kind of come out and people kind of didn't give it any stock. So they weren't even looking for fingerprints in these crime scenes for the most part. Just throwing that out there. All right, so Marianne Nichols, as I said, the area was such a bad place that Jack the Ripper, after this first crime, was already labeled a serial killer because two murders had occurred in the proximity within 330-mile radius, where Nichols was believed to be the first victim of two other women. All right, so Marianne Nichols has said, although two murders had occurred in the same proximity within 330 miles, she's believed to be his first actual victim. Her murder was originally linked to previous murders, those of Emma Elizabeth Smith and Martha Tabram, both of who were prostitutes killed within 3 months of Nichols. But numerous newspapers maintain that the murders were somehow connected, and some still believe that they were. However, Nichols was the first victim universally credited to Jack the Ripper. So Nichols, at the age of 42, married William Nichols in 1864, though they had not seen each other for 3 years at the time of her death. They had 5 children, very productive people.
Well, I guess there's probably not a lot to do in 1880s London.
No, yeah. So it's alcohol and making babies. So they did that. She was a known prostitute. She had previously actually been kind of lucky. She had held a job as a domestic servant. Like I said, if you had a job that wasn't prostitution as a woman in that area at that time, you were doing well, but she lost that job after only 3 months because of her alcoholism.
Let's talk about that for a second. Yeah. Okay. We all know everybody has issues with, you know, that they use alcohol to quell them or whatnot, but do you know anything about like her childhood or anything? Is anything, because I don't think I've ever read anything about, you know, her from an early age, what, you know, might drive her to alcoholism, if it was something in her past or if it was just she had a horrible marriage. And yeah,
you
this know, guy...
I would have to look into that more. I can tell you that I feel she's from that area, right? So she had to deal with that, right? Her parents kind of had the same struggles, I'm sure. Her marriage, honestly, like later her husband says he left her just because of her alcoholism. So I'm not saying he was perfect, but if there's truth to that, it kind of was the destroyer, not the reason that she wasn't necessarily, unless it was a circle, right? She wasn't necessarily doing it because he was bad, but that's why he left her. But maybe he wasn't the best husband and that led to her drinking and it could have been circular, but he says the alcohol is what destroyed them.
Yeah. I mean, it had to be something because you don't just start drinking for no reason. I mean, to that extent and leave 5 kids.
Right.
To go be a prostitute when you have a good job.
She actually, to support her alcoholism, stole from the place. So it was like, leave or be fired. It was like the end. There was no going back. So
yeah, it's really a sad tale, you know, because if
it is, I mean, that think about in life. I don't know if people think about this kind of thing. You really can't if you're still here. Right. But like that one decision kind of killed her. Right.
There's it absolutely did. Yeah.
In life that take your life. Right? Had she stayed at that job, not become a prostitute, she would have, I was going to say she'd still be here. That's also not true. But she probably would have died some other way, right? You know, and hopefully.
Oh, I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. Absolutely. That, I mean, like you said, that one decision to have alcohol control her life is what ended it.
Yeah.
Ultimately.
So anyways, by this point of her being a prostitute, her husband is gone, right? He's left her because of the alcoholism. She's moved into a common lodging house where she shares a bed with an elderly woman named Nellie, right? So the way these lodging houses work, you've got to pay every single night for your bed, right? So because these women don't have much money, they'll split beds and et cetera. So she has a person that she normally stays with. She also goes by Polly Nichols and, like I said, was a known prostitute and was seen walking the Whitechapel Road in search of customers prior to her death at 11 p.m. on August 30th. Just to give a little pre-snap of, you know, she's going to die on the 31st, right? So 11 p.m. August 30th is right before she dies. So at 12:30 a.m. on August 31st, she visited the Frying Pan Lodging House where she was asked for 4 pence required for a bed. She did not have the money, so she said that she would get it soon and headed back out. They also said that she was a very jolly person. She was in no way worried. She's like, oh, I spent it all 3 times today. I'll get it back, and went back out about her way, right?
That's another sad thing about her is that she wasn't, you know, her situation was horrible, but
she's not bitter.
She was like happy and pleasant to be around. Maybe that's the alcohol, so she could her troubles.
I'm just kind of a product of what you know, right? I mean, I don't know why geishas popped in my head, but if like everyone you know works in a geisha, you're probably happy with your geisha friends, right? It's just the life you live.
Oh, it's just so strange to me.
But, yeah, I mean.
We have first world problems.
So. Yes, in the privileged lives that we lead, it's like, man, why wouldn't you be trying to get out of there? It's like, she probably has no concept of that even being a possibility in the world, right?
Well, yeah, and I think something else that's interesting is that, you know, you pay for a bed. I mean, literally, that's all you're paying for is a bed. But at the same time, they, and there's a saying that goes along with this, but like they actually had ropes strung across alleyways. And I think you paid something like a penny or something, because if you couldn't afford a bed, you could literally buy a little piece of that string and sleep over it, hunch over the string and sleep.
Wow. But it kind of shows you the extent of her. I mean, I think we've already gone over it a lot, but like the extent of her alcohol issues, right? Like if it cost her job, it cost her her marriage. She said multiple times to a couple of people that night that she had spent that money 3 times over.
Yeah.
And like I said, she wasn't even worried about it, but she had the money to pay for her bed, but can't prioritize the bed. So spends it on alcohol 3 times.
Well, I mean, maybe she's very, very confident in her abilities to make that money.
These guys are easy. I got this. I mean, that could be too, right? For sure. But it's just kind of sad because you think you would be like, this is my rent. Put that in my pocket. Everything else I get tonight, party on, right? But
exactly,
can't even make that kind of cutoff, right? So so she didn't have the money. She headed back out. The last person who saw her alive was a fellow inmate of the lodge named Emily Holland, who tried to get her to return because she was so noticeably drunk. She's like, you got to go back. But Marianne said she had spent her money fee 3 times that day and would soon get it back and headed off towards Whitechapel Road.
There's that confidence.
Yeah. So Whitechapel Road, I've mentioned it a couple times, but just so to make it clear, that's the road where the prostitutes hang out, right? So she's back out to do her thing. At 3:40 a.m., a car man named Charles Allen Cross thought he saw a tarpaulin, which is a sheet of cloth, for those who didn't know, which would be me, which is why I looked it up, lying on the ground. But upon further inspection, he realized it was a woman's body. This was on Bucks Row, a street that is now called Durwood Street. It's been Durwood Street since 1892, so a long time. The body was just 150 yards from the London Hospital. They kind of gave a breakdown of things near it, right? I think just because it's showing you that these would have been populated areas, even at this time of night, right? The hospital's right there. Mm-hmm. Robert Paul was driving by and saw Cross just standing there staring. So he stopped and the two inspected together. So he pulls up and Cross is just kind of like not knowing what to do. They go together. The body was face up with the eyes open, legs straight, and the skirt was pulled up over the knees. Her left hand was on a gate of a stable that she was in front of, right? So she was slumped down, but she actually had her hand up onto the gate as if she was
about to enter. Before we go further, for those of you listening, we do go over pretty gruesome details of these murders. So if it's something that you get squeamish about, you might want to reconsider, because we're getting ready to get into some.
Don't reconsider. Pretty, fast forward.
Yeah, fast forward. Fast forward a little bit, because yeah, the details aren't pretty at all.
All right. So, like I said, her hand was on the gate. Cross touched her face, and it was still warm, but her hands were cold, and he believed she was deceased. Paul, that's the driver that pulled up, the second person. He was unsure if she was dead or not. He kind of thought she might just be drunk. They actually were kind of decent gentlemen, so they pulled her skirt back down to cover her up, and then they went to look for an officer. Mm-hmm. I forgot to mention, they were both on their way to work at the time. So that's what their kind of alibi was, that they were heading to work. So at that point, they go to look for an officer, and they found PC Meisen, who went to search the scene, though PC John Neal actually found her while they were getting PC Meisen, because it was on his beat. He inspected her with a lantern and flagged down fellow officer PC Thane. Just kind of going back to the point, like I said, these beats were very tight knit. They were very close. So all of a sudden you've got three officers there. That's how ballsy this dude is. It's like there's police everywhere, right? And so three of them can converge quickly.
These beats are probably what, like a block away, a block apart, something like that.
Yeah, I'm thinking block, two blocks tops, yeah. Right? They would have close. To be. That's why they have the whistles, right? You blow the whistle, three other dudes from other beats are like right there on you. So, it was kind of a new thing in London to do these beats, and they were very tight knit little areas that you manned your beat every night. That's what you did, right? So, PC Thane, who went off to get Surgeon Llewellyn after seeing a woman with her throat cut, and surprisingly, no blood trails around her and no wheel marks on the road, right? So Jack the Ripper appeared not to be in a vehicle, and he cut her throat, but there's no blood anywhere on the ground.
That's weird, right? Because, I mean,
it is weird.
So I'm assuming if he cut her throat, she would have already had to have been dead, because I mean, just a carotid artery, that would produce quite a bit of blood. So I'm guessing he strangled him first, maybe?
Yeah, and we'll get into that, but you're right, 100% on the money is what happened is he killed them, and then the cuts all come afterwards, which kind of really shows you the extent of hatred he had for these people, right? He's already killed you. Now he's going to mutilate you.
Yeah, but I mean, that... It's just weird because, like, you think of a sadistic killer, that would be something you'd think he would want to do prior to killing them, to inflict a max amount of pain, unless pain wasn't what he was going for.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there are some of the scenes that he does later, you know, are more ballsy, more bloody, a little bit riskier. Maybe this first one, he was just a little bit afraid to spend too much time there, right? And if don't kill her first, you have more chance of her screaming out
true.
Someone being alerted, right? So at least if he killed her first, he can kind of look around and do his thing. Maybe that was just a first crime incident on that, but I think it does also kind of show his anger and hatred towards the people, just because he could have just been like, okay, I killed her, let me go on, and then next time I'll get riskier. But no, he's like, nope, now I'm gonna like take my time and mutilate her.
Yeah.
And we go further into the timeline on this, you'll see that it was a very short period of time of after the killing and people showing up. So he was super risky, even on this first one.
You know, people saw him though. There's no way he could have gotten away that quick without somebody seeing him.
I forget what the psychological term is for it, but there was a crime that occurred. Man, I'm going to mess these details all up. So I'm just going to leave out time periods. But I feel like it was in the 70s, 80s, where a woman was like beaten and raped in a corridor. And there were houses all around it. Wow. And they said people were like looking out the window and stuff. And like everyone just assumed, and this is where there's an actual term for it, but I can't remember what it is. Everyone just assumed someone else would do something. Like the bystander effect or something, right? So no one did anything. And I think probably in a lot of times, like that kind of thing happened with Jack the Ripper, right? And then the lighting's so terrible that even if someone saw him, it's like, you'd be like, I saw like a shadow, and he was humped over another shadow, right? I mean, there wouldn't have been a lot of ability to give too much detail.
Yeah, I mean, that, and also crime is regular. there. Right. And murders aren't uncommon. I mean, they're not every day, but, you know, right. It happens. So I guess, I don't know, maybe the people are just desensitized to it. They just don't.
Yeah, really. I was going to say that too, is like in an area where it's like an everyday thing, probably a lot of people just have the mindset of not my business. I just keep to myself. Right.
Yeah.
Sad, but if that's the life you live and that's every day, you can see how that could occur.
Oh yeah, sure. For sure.
Yeah. So PC Thane went to get Surgeon Llewellyn, and the surgeon arrived at Buck's Row at 4 a.m. and he determined that she had been dead for only about 30 minutes. If we look earlier in the timeline, right, they discovered her at 3:40, right? So yeah. 30 minutes before 4 o'clock when this guy gets there is 3:30. So they got there, the two first people that found her, 10 minutes after right. He killed her, right? So it was a real tight window. The surgeon asked the PC Thane to take her body back to Old Montague Mortuary for inspection. A buzz about the murder quickly occurred, like instantaneously people started showing up, including three horse slaughterers named Terry Tompkins, James Mumford, and Charles Britton. The men were eventually eliminated as suspects, but because they were horse murderers and showed up out of nowhere, they became the first official, unofficial suspects, right? But they were quickly determined that they were just dudes from work that had stepped out to get a beer. So
you know what's funny about this? This just goes to show you that it doesn't matter what time frame you're in, what period, what era, everybody always has to rubberneck.
Yes.
Because, you know, especially I don't know if it's just a human characteristic that we're so enamored by morbidity and the macabre that we just have to see it for ourselves. Because you see all the neighbors come out immediately, you know, when they hear a dead body. You know, you jump back to Pearl Bryan in the late 1800s. Everybody flocked to her death scene. They were taking sticks and branches and leaves that had her blood on it. I don't know why you want to do that, but okay. You know, and I mean, just even now, when you're on the road, if you see a bad accident, what do? You slow down because you want to see what's going on.
Yes.
Human nature is incredible.
Luckily for us now, with the amount of police we have and they've got guns and things that make them a little more scary, yeah. And etc., they can quarantine off an area and get people the hell out of there. Because
right.
The last thing you want to do in a murder scene is remove the body immediately. Like, you yes. don't want to disturb anything until everything's been thoroughly investigated. Then pieces start being taken away, right?
Right.
And I don't mean pieces of body. I mean everything that's left
behind. The evidence.
Yes, right. Like, so for him to immediately come and be like, get her the hell out of here, that's only a product of the times. That's
because absolutely.
These people showed up and there's no way for these three officers to get these like 50, 100 people to go away, right? So they've right. got to remove her body. So, like I said, they were eventually eliminated as suspects. The residents of Buck's Row, as you said, and the police, they all showed up, and the police and them report that nothing out of the ordinary, no noises prior to the discovery of her body. They hadn't seen anything. So, like you said, there were probably people that saw and heard things, but no one's reporting anything, right? So at least we know no one's saying they saw anything.
Right.
Once the surgeon gets back, you know, with her body taken away and he's inspecting her, he discovers bruising on both sides of her face caused before the knife wounds to the throat. He said the bruising could have been from two things. He either struck her, which would be most obvious, or they said it could be thumb marks from him holding her face and pressing his thumbs into her face, like,
yeah,
like poking her eye sockets with his thumbs right underneath the eye sockets.
That wouldn't be enough to strangle her, though. I mean,
no, and that would have to be prior to strangling her, right? So
yeah for her to bruise, it would have to be prior.
Yeah,
but that's weird. Okay, go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, so I mean, either he struck her a couple times before he strangled her, or he grabbed her by the head and then lowered his hands and started strangling her would probably make the most sense, I would think.
Yeah.
And then he found the knife wounds, obviously, on the throat. One wound was 8 inches and one was 4 inches in length, but both were deep enough that they went all the way to her vertebrae.
That's so some hardcore stabbing right there. God. Yeah, some
hardcore throat stabbing. Two cuts to her vagina, and her abdomen was slashed so that her bowels poured out.
God.
Several of her teeth were missing, which could add to maybe if she had been struck, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. And it also could be from hitting the ground when she fell at the end. But if she had one hand up on the gate, she probably didn't fall all the way down. So it probably more so struck.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah. Her tongue had a laceration. So her tongue was cut.
Well, that might have been if he like punched her or something. I mean, she could have bit her tongue and it just like sliced it or something.
Absolutely. 100% makes sense. Yeah. And like I said, like forensics were so shitty back then. They probably couldn't tell the difference between a slash on a tongue from a tooth or a knife.
Oh, you're absolutely right. Yeah. I mean, literally, there really weren't for forensics back then.
So as we kind of discussed earlier, due to lack of blood at the scene, it was determined that the vaginal abdominal cuts were done post-mortem, right? So after she died, he's chopping. Dr. Llewellyn Ellen believed the killer had a certain amount of anatomical knowledge just based on the precision of some of the cuts. It was believed that the knife could have been a cork cutter or a shoemaker's knife. So for cutting corks for wine and shoes, which would be a similar substance, I would assume at that point, right? The sole of a shoe, a cork.
It doesn't sound like a very big knife, though.
No, I don't know why. Maybe it's because I've seen pictures of some of the theories of knives. But in my mind, I see small and hooked. Right? Small and a little bit hooked.
Yeah.
And I think that, those are some of the theories he had with knives. So. All right. So no organs were removed in this victim. The only reason we have to bring that up is that he later gets a little bit more risky or a little bit more in depth in what he's doing. And so it has to be said that in this first victim, he did not remove any organs. It's estimated the crime itself took 4 to 5 minutes in totality. So he's striking her. He's cutting the throat twice. He's cutting the vaginal area twice. He's cut the bowels. This all takes 4 to 5 minutes.
Okay. I do have anatomical knowledge myself because I went through medical school, so I have basic understanding of the body. Why would they think he had any kind of medical training or anything like based off of this particular? Because I mean, with the exception of spilling her bowels, I mean, he wasn't really doing anything that was anatomically difficult. So that's always kind of been in the back of my mind as to why they thought he was a medical doctor.
I think just it was based a combination of spilling the bowels, and I didn't kind of write down everything, right? Because it's such a lot, right? That couldn't go into all of it. But they believed that his knowledge that it wouldn't leave a lot of blood based on doing the cuts after the killing was something that not everyone would have known. However, well, you would think, though, had this person been like those three dudes from the slaughterhouse, right? They would know that.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't have to be a medical doctor to know about killing things, right? There's butchers and
just have to be a butcher at the very least, I would think,
right? But yeah, so that combined with the spilling the bowels, but also again, if you're cutting animals in any sort of way for a job, then you also would know how to take out the bowels. So
right,
I don't know why he thought that, but it was just a thought, right, that he had come up with, that it was a possibility. So Nichols possessed no identification. Her belongings that were found upon her were a white handkerchief, a broken mirror piece, and a comb. I assume she's got a broken mirror piece just because of poverty, right? That's just what she looks at herself when she combs her hair, right? Her petticoat was marked Lambeth Workhouse, PR, and indicated that she had lived at the Princess Road Workhouse, where a fellow inmate, Marianne Monk, later identified her. So luckily she's got this coat that comes from a specific boarding house that tells them, you know, where people might know her. And so she's identified. Her husband, William, does confirm that it is her. And the one thing that they credited him with uttering upon his arrival there was, "I forgive you as you are for what you have been to me." After he identified her, he said that, right? So it's kind of a weird thing to say, but I think he just, I don't know.
Probably
I mean, to me, I would just feel guilt ridden. I'd be like, why did I leave this woman? Now she's dead. But like, I think that she had been a lot to him in, as far as the alcoholism, and it probably tore him up to an extent to lose that relationship. And she, you know, I don't know. I wasn't there. Probably put him through a lot. That's at least what he kind of said. Right. So,
yeah. I mean, it would have to be emotional regardless. Cause I mean, at one point, you know, he did love her, and I mean, she's the mother of his kids. So, I mean, it had to be hard.
All right. They have 5 children for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was very specific that her 5 children are his children. So It's not like I said, if forensics were bad back then, we didn't have Maury Povich sitting around with a DNA test either. But from what we got,
you are the father.
Yeah, it must have been real unfortunate back then, right? Like, you don't even need Maury. It's just if she's like, you are the father, you can't even dispute it. It's done.
Oh my gosh.
All right. So anyways, an inquest was opened on the following day. PC Neal said that only light near the crime was at the end of the row, right? As we discussed earlier, it was one of those lanterns at the end of the row. And that Whitechapel Road was very busy at the time of the murder. So the killer must have escaped that direction, right? So he basically like takes her down this little alley, does his thing, and then jumps right back into the heart of the prostitutes on Whitechapel Road, just because it's super populated and it would make sense for a bunch of people to be there, right? So he's can blend in quickly. I do want to say this too, which was also smart, which might show some anatomical knowledge, which you, as we said, you could have as being a butcher as well. But another reason why he probably wanted to kill the person before putting the blood out is if he walked back into a busy area like Whitechapel Road, he probably didn't want to be drenched in blood, right? So he probably didn't have a whole lot of blood on him because he killed her prior to making the cut.
That's a good point.
Right. So her father said she had no enemies in the world and that she had separated from her husband many years prior. Her husband, William, said that he had left her due to alcoholism. And he agreed that they had not seen each other in years. The only initial true suspect was a man that local prostitutes called Leather Apron. He was someone that they had, the police had known about prior. He made shoes out of leather, which kind of would also add to why, you know, like possibility of a shoe cutting knife being the killing of the person. If you believe this guy was the guy, right, then he probably would use something of the sort. But his name was John Pizer, and he was a local Jew, and he was said to intimidate prostitutes with a knife to steal from their earnings. So we at least know he's harassing prostitutes on a regular basis. They've all spoken of him, at least. I don't know if they're actively reporting him to the police because they're also prostitutes, right? And they have things to hide. And I'm not putting down prostitutes. I'm saying that you can't, as a criminal, go to the police and say, hey, this other criminal's bothering me. You know what I mean? Like, well, maybe you could then. I don't know.
Wait, was prostitution illegal back then?
Ooh, that's actually a really good question. It might not have been, huh?
I don't think it was.
So, yeah, they probably knew who he was then because they've been reported many times.
Well,
yeah, that's a good point.
I don't know, though. I mean, it may have been, even if it was legal, I'm sure prostitutes were still frowned upon and not thought of as, you know, human beings, you know?
Yeah, 100%. These were the dregs of society in the eyes of the elite.
Which is sad.
Yeah. So this guy, John Pizer, denied his involvement. He was arrested on August 10th. He's the official first Jack the Ripper real suspect. But after the next murder, he was arrested after the second murder, right? Which we're not going to go into now. That'll be next week. But his home was searched and 5 large knives were found. However, due to his airtight alibis, Pizer was released and cleared as a suspect. So at least during a few of the killings, he's not able to have been the killer. So Pizer, although he makes a whole lot of sense, no, as far as being Jack the Ripper. Pizer also received monetary compensation from a newspaper that said that 100% definitively he was the killer. So his life actually worked out pretty well. Number one, he gets to rip off all these prostitutes. Then he goes to jail for like 10 minutes. And then the newspapers have to give him more money. So this a-hole, right? Just torturing
him. Yeah, he's banking on it.
Left and right. So that occurred. Marianne Nichols was buried on September 6th, 1888. Her casket was polished elm with a bronze plaque reading Marianne Nichols, age 42, died August 31st, 1880. In 1996, which is really, really sad that it took 116 years, but in 1996, finally, the City of London Cemetery provided a plaque to make sure that she was remembered properly. Just 2 days after the burial of Nichols, Jack the Ripper would claim his next victim. So that shows you also why Leather Apron quickly arrested, and why I brought that up is it's 2 days after her death. Marianne Nichols' death that he's arrested because another victim occurs right then. So
this guy had no cooling off period whatsoever.
No, he's right back into it. And it could be a lot of what you were talking about, right? Like these serial killers, they tend to escalate. They get a certain amount of, sometimes it's sexual, sometimes it's just emotional, like excitement, adrenaline that they really thrive on and need. And they have to escalate what they do each time in order to increase it. Because if they just keep doing the same thing, it gets boring the same way going to the grocery store would get boring, except that's my favorite activity. So it's a bad example. I love going to the grocery store. Side note. But yeah, so after 2 days, he already was fiending, which shows how hungry this person is, right?
Yeah, I think that's the one thing that's so frustrating about Jack the Ripper is that, you know, these other serial killers that we have in custody, you know, they can tell you, oh, I did it for, you know, BTK. It was strictly for sexual gratification, that type of thing. But I mean, without having him in custody and actually talking to him, we don't know why he was doing this. I mean, it could be
right.
He hated women, so he wanted to desecrate them. Or maybe his mom was a prostitute and she shamed him. And
right.
Or maybe he was secretly gay and trying to have an issue dealing with that. I mean, there's a million reasons why he did what he did, but we'll never know. It's so honestly, annoying.
Like I said, the lack of forensics really makes it very hard to determine because we don't even have the ability to see if he's raped any of these victims, right? So he's mutilating their vaginal areas, which shows he hates them. And if you believe that they were from him, right, he claims to hate prostitutes in several of the Dear Boss letters that he sends to the police, which we'll get into in further episodes. But we also don't know that those letters came from him, right? But since all his victims were prostitutes, you've got to kind of look at two factors. One, he either hates prostitutes, or two, it's just because they're easy. Yeah. They're people that no one cares about, right? So it's people that he can get rid of.
Well, and I don't think he raped them. He may have paid them to have sex to start with, and then maybe in the act or something is when it just triggered something in him or something like that. I mean, yeah, because without that forensic, we don't know if there was any kind of penetration or what. But I mean, with them being prostitutes, that's a great way for him to get a hold of them, you know, say, hey, you want to make some money? And then, you know, doesn't.
Right. And these people are out late at night on a specific road. I mean, they're very easy to find.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, like you were saying, as far as him probably not sleeping with him, I agree, because I think that serial killers, well, I can't say all the time, but I think more likely would sleep with the victim post-mortem, right? Which is...
Well, a lot of them do.
Right. So if he did just get a prostitute, sleep with the prostitute in a normal way, and then flip on him, that would kind of make sense. But we know that the crime took 4 to 5 minutes, so he really wouldn't have had time with Marianne Nichols.
Exactly.
If he did it post-mortem. Right?
Yeah.
So that wouldn't have been a possibility.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Poor Polly.
Yeah.
She's a catalyst to get everything started. God, it makes me wonder what his trigger was, you know, because like the killing, because typically if it's their first killings, a lot of the times it's sloppy and stuff like that. But his, it wasn't. I mean, it was quick and fast and he was out of there and didn't get caught. So it makes me wonder if this was actually his first killing.
Yeah. And like I said, they ruled out those first two. A lot of people ruled out. A lot of people think they still were the first two victims that were within 300 mile radius. I mean, they were knife victims that were prostitutes. So they ruled them out just because of certain types of cutting, etc. But there's no real reason to not think he could have kind of changed as he evolved. It was 3 months later that Marianne Nichols died from the first of those two killings, right? So it's something that could have been evolving for a while. And there is a good likelihood that he was involved with those previous killings as well.
Yeah, exactly. That, I don't know. It's just, I feel bad. I mean, it's hard not to feel bad for these women because they had problems, obviously, because they were alcoholics. And then they're just trying to make a living. God, she's just trying to find money so she can go to sleep in a bed. That's just, it's very disturbing, very sad.
Yeah, it is.
So I think this is a pretty good start to our 6-week series for Jack the Ripper. I think we kind of got into Marianne Nichols a good deal and kind of shed some light on who she was as a person, maybe raise some questions for people to think about. So join us next week for part 2 when we go over another one of his victims. And as always, if you like what you hear, please rate, subscribe, like, follow, contact us. Our email's throughtheabysspodcast@gmail.com. We're on Twitter and Instagram at abysspodcast1. We'll talk to you next week.
All right, guys.
Well, Ben, we got another episode under our belts. Thanks so much for tuning in to Through the Abyss Podcast. And until next time, keep it weird.
Spookly stuff!